Welcome to the Supported Living Property Podcast with your host, me, Lisa Brown, the place to learn about supported living property investing. This is one episode of a series of Lisa Live interviews that were recorded via Zoom and streamed into the Supported Living Property Investing with a Difference Facebook group. It was not studio recorded, and so please accept the sound quality as it is.
As you know, this is our first Lisa Live that we're streaming into the Facebook group. And this is going to be a series of interviews with people who are doing a whole range of different things in supported living so that we can explore all the different strategies, the different facets of it, and try and understand it. And I'm really pleased that Bronwyn's decided to join us tonight. So thank you so much for giving up your evening. I know a lot of people know Bronwyn already, but for those who haven't met Bronwyn or come across her anywhere, I wonder if anyone, if you'd just give us a brief introduction about yourself and how you got started in property.
Yes, of course. Hello, everybody. And thank you, Lisa, for organising all of this. It's just relax, Lisa. It's fine. All right.
Now that's it. That was my technology bit done. So, yeah.
A glass of wine. So I'm Bronwyn Burncombe. Yeah, I've been investing in property now for 6 years. I was a career banker before that, did a bit of work in the NHS for a while. And really, it's in the last few years that my work with emergency housing has really come to the fore. So I've got four different businesses. The one is residential, which I started off with, which is HMOs, holiday lets, single lets, that sort of thing. And then I've got my guest houses, so I'll be talking a little bit about one of those today. And then I've got some developments and an education business. So I like to teach and coach people. So that's why I was ready when Lisa said, you know, I've already got something I prepared earlier. So hopefully, yes, I know that will certainly be of interest to a lot of you coming on today. So yeah, that's me. I'm down in sunny Hampshire. It's been a lovely sunny day today. Live between sort of Portsmouth and Southampton. Winchester.
So, and how did you get into property? What made you make that transition?
Well,
it'd be a really long answer, isn't it? I appreciate it.
It's a very brief one. Okay. I was told I couldn't take my pension until I was 67 years old, and I thought, oh my goodness, there's no way I'm going to wait till I'm 67 to draw money to live off. And I certainly don't want to be working beyond 55 was when my father he took early retirement at 55, and you know, the best years of his life were after that. So that's why I started to think there must be another way, and started to get a really good education. And that's what it's all about, really. Start learning. And then, wow, you know, what a great group property is. You know, so many people want to help you, want to support you. And there's a few rogues out there. We know who they might be, but you know, look at this group, for example. I'm sure we're all going to learn masses from each other. So yeah, that's why I went into property, and it's been amazing. I gave up my corporate job 3 years ago now. I've been around the world. My husband did the clip around the world yacht race, and I followed him. I volunteered in Namibia. I should be in Australia at the moment, but I'm not. So yeah, it's given me massive, massive freedom.
Fabulous.
Yeah. That's really, and I beat my dad.
You did it before him. Brilliant. And how did you get into supported living? What happened there?
Yeah, well, it's a good story as well. I started thinking, well, HMOs are really competitive and really difficult, and it was you know, we'd been doing it for a little while, and we felt that we could do better maybe looking at bigger projects. So we started to look at commercial style properties, and when we were looking, we came across this property which has got 26 bedrooms, and we thought, great, we could convert this into flats. We worked out we could probably create 10 flats, and it's in the middle of Southampton, great location on a residential road, and it had been owned by a charity before we bought it. The charity was selling it. So we said, well, maybe while we get planning permission, we should consider what should we do to create an income from it. so that we don't, you know, we bought it with a bridging loan initially, and that's very expensive, we know that, and some investor funds, and we thought, well, we've got to think through our plan A, plan B, plan C, as you do. And, you know, our plan A was to convert to flats. Our plan B was, what can we do with the rooms? And because the charity was renting, not renting, it was offering accommodation for young offenders. And that wasn't their main home, but it was somewhere they came to rehabilitate, if you like. So we knew that the planning, sui generis planning, was able to be used for short-term letting. So that's how we started, really. We tried different things. Well, I think the big thing was we tried step down NHS, mental health.
Right. How did you try that? How did you go about getting there?
Yeah. So immediately we thought, what's the demand in the area? Middle of Southampton, contractors, you know, a lot of people traveling down to Southampton for various projects on the docks and different things. So we started with contractors. That was okay, but they would generally stay Monday to Thursday, and then they would go home for the weekend. Wow. And we were going, okay, so we'll do booking.com as well, and we'll try the holiday market. Well, it wasn't a great, you know, it wasn't high end this at all. Mm-hmm. Sort of cheap rooms, really. And that worked for a little while, but we came across, we had a good friend of ours that we've been talking to for some time, who runs a pub, and his pub was it was in the middle of Southampton, but it had additional rooms upstairs, and then out the back as well, it had a suite of rooms that you could rent out. So he'd been renting them to local authority tenants, and I thought, wow, that's really interesting. And we'd got to know him a little while because we looked at a pub that he was also managing, and he said, look, if you buy this pub, I'll let the rooms for you. And we thought, great, that'll work. And we got to know him over time. We showed him this 26 bed property, and he came round it with his phone and his phone kept ringing off the hook, and he kept saying, no, I haven't got any rooms. No, I haven't got any space left. And I thought, gosh, there's demand there. So he said to me, I can let these rooms, I could fill these rooms for you. So that's when it started, really. We said, well, if that as a model works, let's give it a go. And he's been a catalyst to everything we've done, really, because we continue to work with him now.
So he had the connections already.
Had the connections, yes. And that's a big, big thing in this marketplace, really.
Yeah. And with his, and he was doing the step down care, was he NHS care? Is that what he was doing initially when you started?
Not really, no. I had some NHS contacts. And I thought, you know, from the sort of conversations I'd had in the NHS, that actually this was something they would really love to have. And we did try different things. So with this guy, Colin, with Colin, we did start to experiment, really. And we did do mental health step down for probably 6-7 months. And it was just really, really hard work. And what we found was that a lot of these people were quite vulnerable. And what we would try to do with the local authority, with the mental health, with those people, was to try to define the type of person that we'd be comfortable having, and not those that are too dependent on other people and need to have too much care. Because what we'd find, our live-in manager would have to be, you know, on duty 24/7, and they were very, you know, needy, really. Mm. And in that first year, I was, you know, setting it all up with my husband, and, you know, we would often be there, and I would see the problems that we had, and I really felt that we didn't have the skill set to really manage this properly. It was secure. It's a secure place. I mean, I can give you some photos. We can talk through my little, you know, a little presentation that will maybe spring lots of questions from other people. Yeah, I don't know how you want to manage that.
I think we'll probably, should we do questions at the end? Would that make more sense?
Probably
easier, isn't it, if we talk, and then if people have questions, we'll do a question section.
Yeah.
10 minutes or so. So after that, then you ended up, or do you want to show the property and talk about it?
Yeah, well, so let's keep thinking about the different tenant types. So the NHS step down, that sort of worked for a bit, but the teaching hospital locally was doing their own accommodation, so it was only really in an emergency they would use us, so it wasn't going to be a regular occurrence. Mental health was more useful. But really what we started to do was, as the local authority departments, because there were about five different departments that we ended up really getting to know quite well, they came out and they would go, okay, yes, this would suit us because of, and this is what we need it for, and if you could provide X, Y, and Z, then it would be perfect for us. And we had other charities come and visit us, and some would say it's not going to work because of this, and others would go, yes, because we didn't have, they're not self-contained rooms, they're shared bathrooms. So although there's 26 rooms, what we've got is 13 single rooms, which are fairly small, and then we've got very large family rooms. So if I share my screen now, I can sort of show you why the property then ended up being the reason why we ended up doing what we're doing, because of the way that it's laid out.
Right, okay.
So let's see if this works. If I share my screen, let's see if you can see this. Can you see my slides now?
I've got a little bit of a pause. Oh, there they are.
Okay, yeah. So this, as long as you can see that, then hopefully other people will as well.
Yeah, it looks like it's just coming.
Yeah. So here's the case study that we're going to talk about, which is Alma Road, 64 Alma Road. You can see that this part of the property here is very old Victorian, sort of Victorian Edwardian, very, very high ceilings, really nice big rooms. And then you've got this bit on the side here to the left as you're looking at it now. And this is it here. These are all purpose-built single rooms on two floors. And then there's a single self-contained one-bed flat at the bottom. And then you've got a car park around the back here. So it's
originally a hotel, was it?
Say again?
It was originally a hotel, was it?
No, it was owned by a charity. So, and they accommodated young people.
Sorry, prior to that, it had been a hotel.
Oh, before that, no, this was almost purpose built. Oh, okay. So they had this thing built at the side for the charity. Right. Yeah. Really interesting, actually. So no, it's never been a hotel of in that way. But you can see there's 26 rooms, 13 single, 13 big family rooms, as we call them now, 7 bathrooms when we bought it. We've now got 9. We've increased that. None of them are self-contained. So it's shared bathrooms. But the family rooms have all got cooking facilities within them. So if I show you... So here we bought it. We bought it for 700,000, but it was on the market for 940,000. So you can see that in a commercial type of purchase, depending on your experience, you can really negotiate very, very well, much, much more easily than residential. But that's for another time. So here's some pictures here of the property pretty much year one. So you can see this corridor here is the corridor of single rooms, and this is a single room. You can see how small it is. You know, yes, we have a TV, you have a sink, and there's a sort of place you can put your clothes, and there's a bedside table as well. And you can see this room down here, bottom left, is that was there already. So you can see the cooking facilities that were in the room at that point. We put in some high sleepers here, these sort of beds, so you can actually sleep more people, and we put in dining facilities and dining tables and things, and sofas in the bigger rooms. So
short stays.
Say again?
These are for short stays.
Short stays, yeah. Absolutely. This is really from, on average, we have people for a week up to 3 months. Sometimes longer in exceptional situation. We have an asylum seeker for nearly a year. But on a per night basis, that's very expensive for the authority to be paying. So yeah, this is only really for short term. And if I explain a little bit about, this is it now. So we have refurbished it in the last 12 months. But if I explain a little bit about the tenant types we have what I call emergency housing, which is what we've ended up doing. Emergency housing is really for those that are in council accommodation at the moment, but they find that through fire, flood, domestic abuse, all sorts of other things that people don't like to talk about, but they need to be housed quickly. Actually, another point worth mentioning is, you know, the cladding on flats, of course, given the horrendous situation in London with Grenfell Tower. There was a whole tower block in Portsmouth that needed to close down quickly. All council tenants, they needed to be housed somewhere before they found them permanent accommodation again. So we had quite a lot of people suddenly, you know, take up our rooms, and our occupancy just went through the roof. So it is just for temporary accommodation. It needs to be safe, you know, very, you know, pretty good quality, in my opinion, because this is about people's lives, and but certainly family accommodation where they can stay together and cook and feel safe and, you know, in the town as well. So that's the location is quite important. Before I go on to the numbers, so emergency housing, and then we have children's department as well. So we have families where children are seen to be at risk, and so the children's department will place families with us, and so again it's really important to have good quality accommodation with lots and lots of bathrooms and somebody on site as well, really important, so they can show them to their room, they can show them laundry facilities and all sorts of other things, really important. I think people are going to be writing lots of questions down, so I'm going to shoot through a couple more slides and then we'll go back to face-to-face. This is the sort of turnover that we've had over the last few years. So you can see we started off around £200,000 turnover when we were mixing and matching and trying different things. Our occupancy levels there were about between 50 and 60% of the rooms occupied at any one time. It would vary hugely. And sometimes the council, when we started using the council, they would empty the place out at Christmas and they would put everybody back with anyone they knew, except they didn't want to pay over Christmas. And then at the end of the year, they don't have any money left. So they put people back with friends and then they bring them back in after April, which is crazy. A bit weird. And then the following year, we consolidated a bit more. We were very focused. We then refurbished the rooms. And so we're turning over around £350,000 now with the 26 bedrooms. And these are the sorts of room rates that you're looking at down here. They vary by council as well. We now have 5 councils across Hampshire that place people with us because they know we're professional, they know they can rely on us. And we have capacity now, and we have capacity because we've expanded. And we've expanded into these 2 other properties. That previous one we actually bought with a bridging loan initially and investors. And then we replaced the bridging loan with a mortgage with Cambridge and Counties after about 6 months. So that was pretty good based on our numbers.
And were they long-term investors, Bronwyn, who stayed with you?
Yeah. Yeah, so we created a special purpose limited company for that purchase, and those investors are shareholders in the company. So my husband and I own 40% and our investors own the rest. We have 4 investors. Mm-hmm. And we share profit through dividend payments. So that's the way we chose to set it up. Of course, we were becoming 100% occupied and there was too much demand. So we then created another company that's just ours. We've got a purchase lease option on this one on the left here, Linden Guest House. And then Polygon Guest House is a long lease. That's a commercial lease for 12 years, I think, this one. And you can see that's quite big as well. That's 18 rooms and then a 6-bed HMO. So that gives us a lot more variety of types of tenants that we can have, and they're all short term again, all just, you know, from one night up to several months. And then we've got a fourth one now, which is which we do street homeless with, but I'm not going to talk about that today. It's a very different marketplace. But yeah, so really it's about what I like to share really is how do you get started researching and looking for empty properties, because we've got so many rooms and we've done it at scale. That's where the economies of scale kick in, that gives you that larger profitability. But of course, what we've discovered is that it's a tenant type or guest type that we have got to know and love. And yes, they're not easy to manage. They absolutely aren't, not all the time. But the good thing about short-term letting is that we can ask them to leave, and we do. And you know, we do have strict rules at times, and you know, people do flout those. And you know, we can ask the local authority to put them somewhere else, and it's a shame if they can't conform. But some people have all sorts of other issues that they're having to cope with, you know. So we found that on the whole, if we provide a really, really nice experience for people, and we're understanding, and we have people come in and help them, then we have people that feel that this is their home, and it's very rewarding then. But of course we have problems. We really do at times, and that's why having a live-in manager is important.
So they're 24 hours. Is it one person who lives in, or is it, do you have a
One person,
right?
Yeah, one person. So let me stop sharing now, because we can have a chat. I can put my contact details up later if we want to, but let's go back to face to face. So yeah, the live-in manager is critical, because what we don't want to do is manage it ourselves. You know, we have a property business, and we have lots of businesses. All our businesses are generally, you know, we outsource the hard stuff from our point of view, but we are responsible. So we do all the back office. Booking system is put in by ourselves. We provide all the computer equipment. We have processes that are followed by our managers. They're responsible to book people in and to manage the property. If anything needs maintaining, then they go to Colin. And we have weekly meetings with Colin. So we manage it really effectively.
So he oversees the live-in staff. Yeah. That's how that works.
Yes, he does. He employs them, actually. We don't employ them.
Oh, okay.
We do interview them together. You know, this is important that we get the right people. Mm. And we do test people out. You know, quite often the best managers have come from a place of vulnerability themselves, because they then have a huge amount of empathy. But also we train them up. So we will give them the skills to use the computer to really be as effective as they can in the job. And we'll give them a trial period. And between myself and Colin, you know, we've got a couple of people now that have changed their life around. I mean, the person that manages 64 Alman Road, he didn't have his children with him, and he was on his own. He'd gone through a lot of problems, and now he has accommodation for free as part of his job. And he's held his job down now for 3 years. He not only has he had his children back, which is wonderful, but you know, he's improved his life skills, and he loves his job. So yeah, it's been brilliant. It's been good to see his progression. And we've had others that have taken the mickey, you know, and you know, that's all part and parcel.
Yeah.
But I think the difference here with my model is that it's a trading business. This isn't like an HMO where you can, you know, it's residential and you can sort of say, great, people are living there on an AST contract. I don't really have to worry too much until something goes wrong. This is day-to-day business. I know what's going on at the moment, you know, and what our occupancy levels are. And I know that I need to make sure I've got enough food for the homeless stuff at the moment, because that's causing us issues. But equally, I can be in Australia as I was last year and still continue to manage the properties and the business from afar. And that's been a really big part of our reason for why we got into property, was so that we can do other things.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that's really important.
What kind of occupancy rates are you running at? What does that vary dramatically throughout the year? I know you'd said about the Christmas time and the end of the financial year for the local authorities, but the rest of the year, is it fairly stable?
Yes, pretty, you know, especially with Alma Road. That's looking about between 80 and 100% occupancy most of the year round, which is good because we've got that continuity now, and that works well. If we take the newest property, then that's taken a while, but that's a slightly different model. So again, you know, over time it becomes much easier. Linden Guest House is more booking.com, so that does vary seasonally. But the emergency housing, as I'm talking about today, primarily, that's pretty good in terms of demand, because we're known and because councils talk to each other. So if a council, you know, really needs to house somebody quickly, they'll all phone each other around and they'll all go, anybody know anyone that's got a room? They will be phoned up. You know, we're not the only supplier, clearly, you know, but we will get that phone call to say, have you got a room available? Mm. But we don't guarantee rent. We invoice the council. So some councils pay in advance with a credit card, which is interesting. And other councils, we have to have a purchase order number, which is a nightmare. And then we have to send an invoice out, and then we have to chase invoices. So it's a big business from that point of view.
Yeah, I can imagine that's quite time consuming. Yeah.
It can be, but we're trying to systemize everything as as we've grown. We've had to, really, because otherwise we'd have to employ more people to help.
Have you had any problems getting paid when you're saying you're chasing invoices? Do you normally get the money? I know sometimes with local authorities.
Not always.
You have, yeah.
Not always. And I think it's partly because we weren't very good at chasing invoices when we first started out. So we've got, we've probably got about £40,000 owing to us at the moment. But when you look at the sort of turnover that we're doing, that's not too bad. But you do need to have good systems to keep on top of it, because if we don't get the money in, then Colin doesn't get his money either, you know. So we're all incentivized to make sure that this works well. But like any business, it's, you know, needs managing. And that's why I think this model is a bit different. It isn't for everybody, but it is something I love to talk about, because I think that this can work anywhere in the country.
Do you think it could work on a smaller scale if someone was looking at property that was, say, six or seven,
it absolutely could. You've just got to make sure that you're going to get the right type of guests in that are not going to be too demanding. You could, you know, again, looking at your property, you've got to say, is this good enough for families who may want to be cooking and, you know, having their family all together in one place? I mean, for our single rooms, we've got a massive kitchen in that property that has got two of everything. John Lewis's gave it to the charity and had it sort of built for them, which is wonderful. So we can have people use that kitchen facility. So the smaller properties, you've got to think about, everybody's got to use the kitchen at different times. And do you really want a live-in manager? That's
where the scale is important.
Yeah. So I think that's probably most of what I was going to say, and I don't want to take up too much time. I want to give people
time for questions,
maybe, because I could go on for hours.
Let's have a look and see what kind of questions we've got going on.
Sure.
So
I'll put my contact details back up on the screen.
Yeah, that would be great. Do you always seek commissioner backing from the local authority? Was one of the questions.
Do we get
commissioner backing from the local authority?
Commissioner backing, I'm not quite sure what that means.
You just liaise with the, who is it within the local authority that you're liaising with?
Okay, so it's the individual department heads. So and every council's different, so they all have slightly different department names, which is not helpful for people, but I do mentor people in different parts of the country, so I know that this is the case. You know, it's finding the right department that is going to work. you know, that the whole of the council sort of are aware of what we do now, because what we had an HMO officer put a letter through our door saying we needed an HMO license, which is like, actually, no, we don't. And you know, they,
and why don't you, what is it that's doing?
Yeah, we don't, because we have a sui generis planning for short-term letting, and the rules are different. But you know, even if we did need a license, they would come and they'd measure the rooms and make sure we were providing enough. We know we do, but you know, it's just another level of bureaucracy. And you know, so what we did was we talked to the departments that we work with, and we said to them, look, we've had this letter, you know, what do you think we should do? And they said, oh, don't worry about it, we'll phone them up now and tell them that, you know, you're providing this service and that they shouldn't be hassling you. So it's really weird how councils work. I think the important thing is getting to know them. And what I did early on was actually, even though Colin had contacts, I went to some of the other bed and breakfast places and actually got chatting to the owners and said, you know, you provide accommodation for different types of people. Can you share a little bit with how you do that? I did my own market research.
Right.
And I do recommend that, you know. You will be shocked though. Some of the accommodation is terrible. Terrible.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'd love to know your thoughts on lenders. Happy to lend for emergency accommodation.
Okay, brilliant. Yes. So this was a new venture for us when we started out. So we went to all the banks and we found that actually not all the banks will lend for this type of accommodation. Our research showed us, and our contacts, connections and networks, somebody said, try Cambridge and Counties. And it's they are specialists in bed and breakfast accommodation, this type of accommodation. So they understand how the numbers work. Mm-hmm. We sent them our figures for 6 months and they offered us a mortgage pretty easily, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Find a specialist lender. And your broker won't always know who they are. So it's important to go and talk to other people. So like myself, we are actually looking at remortgaging. So we will be out fairly soon looking at who else is out there, because I think probably more.
Yeah, absolutely. We are planning a couple of sessions with people about finance, because I know it is something that's really specific that people are, you know,
that would be good,
really. So hopefully we can get some answers or find out that everyone's in the same boat. Can you please tell us what the legal process is for getting tenants to leave?
So we're effectively a hotel or bed and breakfast, which means that it's short-term accommodation, a bit like serviced accommodation. You can also ask people to leave if they are not being respectful of the other guests. That's how I like to put it. you know, it's shared accommodation at the end of the day. And if somebody's being particularly noisy or indeed, you know, shouting or being violent on occasions, then we will tell them that they will need to pack their bags and leave. Now, you know, if I was managing it on my own, that's a big thing to be doing to maybe somebody, you know, who might be quite violent. So we do have a number that we can call the local authority if we need to, for security reasons. We don't have to do it at Alma Road at all, but in one of our other properties we do. We can basically ask them to pack and we can march them out, unfortunately. And, you know, generally I think what we find is that if we treat people with respect and we explain what the rules are and why we're asking them, and we get them to calm down, and we have different techniques to do that, then it's absolutely fine. It's just occasionally if somebody's perhaps, you know, been drinking or other substances, then that's also not acceptable.
No.
So, yeah.
Can we go back on, if you can just stop screen sharing for a minute, I just realized we'll come back to your stuff. Can I ask, are you mixing your properties with both emergency accommodation tenants and SA tenants? I think you've answered that, aren't you? You're not.
Not now.
No,
we did try it. We tried the single rooms for contractors and the family rooms for families, but it didn't work. Honestly, it didn't work.
Yeah. imagine. What are the biggest lessons you've learned from your journey so far?
Biggest lessons, I think, perseverance, really. It's easy to give up, and it's easy to make assumptions. And a lot of people, including some investors who didn't invest with us, but they went, oh no, you know, that's never going to work. These people are terrible. They're going to trash the place. They're going to, you know, terrible, terrible. So I've learned that if you respect somebody and you give them respect, then you get it back. Mm-hmm. Equally, if you provide shit accommodation, and I've seen some awful places, these people, it's terrible. I don't mean that at all, but if you and I are staying in a horrible place, will we look after it? No, we won't. We refurbish the place and people want to stay and they like it, so they look after it. And they also start to learn that, you know, respect our rules and you can stay. Of course you can stay longer. And then what else have we learned? We've learned that local authorities are very bureaucratic and difficult to deal with. And again, perseverance, absolutely, you know, don't be fobbed off with, oh no, we don't do that here, because we absolutely do. There's massive demand out there. There are housing associations now that do this, of course. There are different charities that will provide rooms, but quite often they do it on a longer term basis. I think our model of being short term is a little bit different and is needed for those occasions, like Grenfell, like, you know, if there was a flood, and because we know we have lots of floods, you know, people with, especially with children and things, you know, there's no way can they stay in a property that's damp. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Someone's asked, what are the biggest lessons you've learned from your journey so far? I think they're kind of similar, aren't they? But
similar.
I'm trying to do too many things at once. What advice would you give to someone who was now embarking on this journey?
I would say have a chat with me, have a separate conversation. I'm always happy to talk. I think if somebody had been around that I could talk to, then I would have done it quicker. I talked about perseverance, you know. It's been quite hard to change strategies at different times. But if you can learn with somebody who's doing it, then it makes it a lot easier. So that's what I would say. Also make sure you've got finance up your sleeve and perhaps a coach or a mentor that can help you through difficult periods. You know, if there's demand with something like this, you'll find a way of making it happen. You've just got to make sure that you get a return on investment too, because, you know, we're not a charity, but we, you know, we're very giving in other ways. So this is quite a good balance, I think. Yeah.
Someone's asked what sort of yield or return do you get from your properties? And then also who is responsible for maintenance? So I think
Maintenance, yes, really important. You know, there's a lot of costs in this, and I put up a slide before that said, you know, what was my gross profit, what's my net profit. You know, there's a lot of cost involved, and you have to manage that. It's a business. You have to manage this cost. So what we do is we pay our sort of managing agent, if you like, we pay him a percentage of the turnover, and he then is responsible for employing the person that lives in, for laundry and for booking in systems and managing it day to day. If there's any general little bits of maintenance that need to be done, then they can do that. We'll pay for the costs of doing that. We have a system on a platform called Asana, which is a team tool where you can log things on there. So each manager has the ability to log that, you know, oh, I've got a problem with this, or this isn't working, or there's a blocked toilet. You know, they have access to people that we use regularly, plumbers, electricians, things like that. One of the biggest costs are things like, you know, the fire alarm system, making sure that that's working properly, CCTV, really important, insurance, big cost.
Do you get a deposit from the local authorities if there was a room that was damaged very badly, would that be your responsibility, or would that come from?
We will charge the local authority for the damage, yes. And we have an agreement that they will pay that, you know. We do have CCTV for situations where people may walk off with things like televisions. We haven't always got that back. We certainly can't always claim on insurance for that, but the local authority generally pay for damage. We have damaged carpets and things, we can get the carpet changed. It's interesting because the first year we had a lot more incidences than we have since we've refurbished it. So interesting. To answer the other question, what's the return on investment? Now that depends how you want to measure that, but our investors, if you took them as an example, they get a 37% return on their investment on that property. So that gives you an idea of the sorts of things they get. We take the risk because we're managing it day to day, I suppose, but they are shareholders, so they still take a risk to dividend, I suppose.
You're right, there's loads of questions, so we've got okay. Building insurance and liability insurance more expensive for this type of accommodation?
Yes, a lot more expensive, and it depends on your tenant type as well. So if it was I know we had to be very careful, because when we got a few asylum seekers in, I didn't think it was a problem. It was only when I spoke with my broker, as I do every quarter, just to check, is everything okay? You know, are we not, because I don't want to be out of insurance. They said, no, asylum seekers are not included. They're much more expensive to insure. I'm like, really? They're much higher risk? Even though this family was beautiful, they were the best behaved, and they stayed with us for months, we had to end up paying more for their stay. Street homeless, absolutely, yes. And that's fair enough. But I've got a really good broker that's working with me now, where we're putting all the policies onto one overall policy, which actually makes it cheaper.
Right.
So there are ways to reduce that. Yeah.
Do you need any special license to do this, or do you have to register as a public service supplier? That's a question.
Good question. No, we don't. We do need to make sure that we are certified for all the usual things that you would expect, health and safety wise, and that all our certificates are up to date. We do need to supply those to the local authorities so that they know that we're compliant. All the things you would expect to have, pretty much, if you were an HMO or if you were trading in this way, it's absolutely makes sense. But saying that, I went to look at a property a couple of weeks ago for street homeless that someone else was running. It was pretty much empty, but they had no fire alarm system, would you believe? Absolutely. I was fuming at them. I just could not believe they housed people there with no fire alarm system. And I just think that's just not right. And I was surprised that they were allowed to house people. And do you know what they said? Oh my goodness, they said to me, oh, well, it's okay because they're only homeless people. Anyway, I'm not going to go off on one there, but yeah, so you've got to be completely compliant, just as if, you know, this was your home, really, and make sure you have everything. Health and safety wise, we do, our managers go through medical, qualifications that they can deal with crises in an emergency. They do health and safety briefings. They do go, local authority give them some training as well sometimes, which is quite useful. How to manage conflict, how to manage different situations. So yeah, it's amazing. There's so much out there you can do.
Mm-hmm. Is C1 planning accepted for assisted living, or must you get sui generis?
Oh, well, sui generis because of the size of what we're doing. Yeah.
In each of your properties, they're all that.
I think if you're looking at anything, anything large commercially, you need to look at the planning use that's on the planning portal, on the planning details, really important. If it's already a B&B or a hotel or something like that, then you know it's going to be fine, because that's equivalent.
And do you have to have any CQC or any regulatory, apart from, you said, the standard ones, but you don't fall under CQC or anything?
No, we don't. And we've been very careful not to provide those sorts of services, because that would be a very different business. It would be like running a care home or an institution that would look after people. You could absolutely do that, but that would be, in my opinion, it'd be a minefield of a lot of, not bureaucracy, but, you know, rules and regulations, and you would have to keep up to speed with those. There's nothing wrong with doing that. It's just not really the business that we wanted to be in. Right. So I'm sure there's people on this who do that.
Mm-hmm. There's so many different ways of doing things. And someone else is saying, as a starter, how big are you before councils may even pay attention to you? How many rooms offering as a minimum?
Oh, I don't know, actually.
I suppose you were offering a lot of rooms from the beginning, really.
We were. And then I've been to see other bed and breakfasts. I think the smallest one I've seen is probably 10 rooms, where they provide that, and they live in. So the people that run it live in there themselves. I think, you know, yeah, it's all about, really, is it going to work logistically?
And is there any tips on that when you're viewing properties? Is there things that you think that, you know, they must have this or not this? Or
yes, numbers of bathrooms. So I looked at one fairly recently that had 12 rooms, and it was very excited because it used to be a care home, and I thought, great, there'll be lots of bathrooms. And in fact, they said, yes, there's a toilet in every room, and there was a toilet and a sink off every room, but no shower facilities. And when we looked at the floor plan, you could see there was only one bathroom. It's like, oh my goodness, that's not going to work. Now you can obviously add them too, you know, but we needed rooms very quickly on that one, and one bathroom isn't enough. We've now got 9 for 26 rooms, and that's plenty actually. But, you know, if there's a problem with one and we have to shut it for maintenance, you know, or if there's a leak or something, you've got to have spare ones. So bathrooms are really important, and because we don't provide en suites, and in fact that's actually good.
Why is that good?
Because if you're providing self-contained facilities, you might fall foul of future regulations. Yes, I think it's good that people are coming and going, and
yeah,
you know, they're not just isolated in their room and not seeing anybody. So,
okay, yeah. Fabulous. I think there've been some other questions, but I think they were answered earlier in the
thing. Okay.
As you finally said, people can reach out and make contact with you.
Yes.
If you want to put your contact details back up on there.
Yeah, if people want to, that's fine.
I think people are, you know, I know that you'd said you've got some information to email people out. Oh, sorry to spring it on you.
I do. I prepared earlier.
If people want to contact you to get hold of that,
you can email me. You can email me at this address here. It's a bit of a mouthful, actually. propertyinvestingfoundation.com, Bronwyn @. Or you'll find me on social media. So with a name like that, you know, there aren't many of us.
At least
on social media. ping me your email address on social media, and I'll send you out the PDF summary, really. Hopefully that will be enough for you. And then, you know, you can book a call. So I've got this diary booking system, because I do coach people and things regularly. So you can book a slot within my diary, which means it's really easy. You can find a time that suits you. And I know that I block out that time every week. So it's really easy.
Thank you. That's very generous of you. And thank you for giving up so much time this evening to talk through. It's been really interesting. Thank you, Bronwyn.
Good.